from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 28th, 2019. Yes, the last Sunday of July. Hard to believe the month of July is almost over. Well, this is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And I have to say, you know, the weather, yeah, it's humid today and hot, but the weather has been just absolutely fantastic. And this week ahead, I looked at the week ahead forecast, and it looks tremendous.
And there's only one word of advice. Get out and enjoy it.
That's exactly right.
For too long, it won't be here.
Stop that.
Yes, please stop that.
Okay, I'm stopping.
It just
I'm
got stopping. Here, okay?
Yeah, right. I know.
And we've waited long enough.
Mm-hmm. But... Oh, I'm reading Tom Skilling's forecast into the week here.
Yes.
And for Tuesday... Well, tomorrow will be cooler because of storms moving in overnight tonight and early tomorrow morning. But afternoon highs tomorrow in the 80s. Tuesday, mostly sunny, cooler, not as humid, high in the low 80s. Wednesday, mostly sunny, comfortable temps, upper 70s. And to begin August, high pressure dominating the Great Lakes region, mostly sunny, a little warmer, once again, high in the low 80s. So we are looking at a great week ahead.
Got to get your grilling on.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, yes.
I'm doing a little pulled pork today.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
I'm looking forward to that.
I've done chicken and fish on the grill so far.
What kind of fish?
The trout that I like.
Ooh.
You can get a nice, great big piece of lake trout and put that on the grill, season it to taste. And if you don't eat the whole thing, wrap it up good. It makes a great sandwich the next day.
Absolutely. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Now, what are you grilling today?
I'm not going to have time. I can't do it today.
I know. You
here
have
I
a
am.
Busy...
I'm defeating my own advice here.
Yes, but yes. I do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah. Today, a little tight schedule. And that's going to be the case for a few days next week. So I will make time to do it one way or another.
Well, just
week.
So you let me know.
Okay.
I mean...
Save some of that pulled pork for us.
There won't be any left. I can promise you that. It will be gone.
The bacon blue cheese coleslaw salad in the mix here as well?
You know, no. I just did regular coleslaw.
Oh, you did regular?
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit, I've kind of overdosed on that bacon blue cheese coleslaw and just needed a little bit
break
of a break.
From it.
Yes, yes, yes. there's still more summer. I'll be making more.
Oh, yeah.
But I had thought about wearing my Blackhawk sweater today with the Blackhawks mm-hmm. convention going on. But when I saw the temperatures and the humidity, I thought, I'll just stick with my Blackhawks hat instead.
Probably a good idea.
Well, I remember that first parade, the 2010 Cup Parade, and it was hot and it was humid. And it was like, I almost got dehydrated.
Were they blocked off Michigan Avenue?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. It and that was not ideal hockey sweater weather.
No,
but it's the Stanley Cup. You know, you have to dress well for that. And I had to take the sweater to the dry cleaners afterwards. It was
the plain old washing machine.
No, the washing machine ain't going to do it.
So it was kind of game worn at that point.
It was gamey.
Going to say gamey. I didn't want to go there, but since you did, we're looking at relative humidity now at 7:13 a.m. 79%.
There you go.
So dew point is at 66.
Ooh.
Yeah, we're getting up there.
It's
going to be a warm day at the ballpark there for you, Andy.
Yeah, it's a good thing our booth has a little AC
going on.
Yeah, not too bad.
Well, hopefully the bats will stay hot out there.
It would be nice. I mean, it's been a little bit of a frustrating homestand with the great beginning with Ivan Nova pitching the complete game against the Marlins and then losing two straight to a couple of very young and very talented Marlins pitchers, and then, of course, the Twins, who just all they do is hit home runs.
Yes, isn't that the truth?
Oh, my goodness. Game one of that series, 5 home runs, and it's the 9th time they've done that this year. That's a new major league record.
Wow. How many times?
9 times they have hit 5 or more home runs in a game.
Wow.
And it eclipsed a record that was held by the 1977 Boston Red Sox with 8.
Jeez. I mean, yeah, I knew this is a home run hitting team, but I think it was, with the Giolito, he had given up 3 homers in 3 innings?
Yeah, and it was like batting practice, and and Giolito's an all-star, and this is
right.
Not a guy that's trying to give up home runs, obviously. It's just, it starts a lot of debate because there's some players on the Twins team. I was looking back at some of their records from last year. As a team last year, they hit 166 home runs. They have 201 right now. So something tells me that the ball might have a little life to it this year.
What's different about this picture?
Yeah, I think the ball has a little bit of a little carry to it, if you will.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you go to the store to buy the golf balls that have a little quote-unquote extra distance. Yeah, I think baseball shopped at the extra distance store before the season started.
And what store was that, Andy?
That was at Schwanee Mart.
Thank you.
Schwanee Mart.
Where everything is marked up 600%.
Customer service.
It's just an afterthought.
Check out our sporting goods department.
Yeah. Sporting, yes. Goods, I don't know.
Oh, I just learned about Schwanee Mart this morning.
Yeah. It's only been open for about a week, so it's...
may not be open next week.
I think it's going to be shut down, yes. The Board of Health is going in there as well.
Oh, well, what's on sale at Schwanee Mart this week?
Nothing.
Yeah. I think that jersey that you wore might be on sale.
Yeah, it's exactly,
Before it went to the clear.
Yeah. Mark to go. Uh-huh. Yes.
Price to move.
Indeed. Oh, Schwanee Mart. Oh, man.
Yep.
Who's your celebrity endorser for Schwanee Mart?
Oh, let's see. We need to come up with one.
One wants to lend their name to Schwanee Mart.
He's now on L list. He's gone through the A, B, C, D, and E.
No one wants to do it.
Oh, man.
I've made some phone calls. None of them have been returned.
Poor guy.
Oh, you are a beloved figure. Trust me. So we got.
I've been trying to come up with a logo for this.
Oh, I don't even want to picture that right now. You're starting mental
right
images
now.
In
I
my
know,
head.
I know.
I know this is, theater of the mind here, but wow.
We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, please. What's going on with my cubbies?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I do not know the answer to that because it was supposed to be solved, the late-inning bullpen situation, by the addition of Craig Kimbrell, and it hasn't really been.
Yeah, it worked out well last night.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere that I believe in his previous save opportunities over the course of his career, he had given up 2 home runs in an inning once or twice. I think it was once.
Really?
And he's already done it twice this year.
Yeah, I'll admit I did not stay up for the end.
You're lucky.
Yeah,
you're very
so,
lucky.
So is my TV, I think, because 2 home runs in the bottom of the 10th.
Yeah, after the home run by Almora that put the Cubs up 3-2, and then you go to the bottom of the 10th inning, and Yelich, the first man up, just clubbed one. And then Kenton Hira, the rookie... It looked like it was going to be a double. It would have ended the game anyway.
Uh-huh.
But it just snuck over the right field wall, opposite field shot, a line drive that maybe got about 50 feet off the ground and went out for a home run.
Oh, just frustrating. And so I was checking, the last several games. So we're playing 500 ball.
Pretty much. Yeah, 5-5 in the last 10 games.
And you've got St. Louis and Milwaukee are start playing like 7-3.
Yeah. And the Cubs are percentage points. It's basically a virtual tie for second with the Brewers behind the Cardinals now.
Right. I think it's one percentage point difference.
One more game, I believe, is the difference.
Right. But this is like, I mean, now is, this is playoff time.
It's playoff time, and I think there's a lot of questions that need to be answered on that side of town with the trade deadline coming up this week. And, you know, what do you do? They brought up Ian Happ. Is it a showcase to try to trade him? Or is it him going to be the replacement for Addison Russell, who was optioned out? What do you do as far as the bullpen is concerned? Because you've got Pedro Strop, who's not exactly doing what he's being paid to do. You know, it's kind of a mix and match, a hodgepodge of guys that you don't really have a defined role for, except for Kimbrel. And you know, in all fairness to Kimbrel, this is still like the first month of the season for him.
Right. This is actually spring training in some respects for him. But still, he is supposed to be the stopper.
Correct.
He is the closer,
and he's being paid handsomely to do it,
and not the guy to give up two home runs an extra inning ball game.
Yeah, I mean. You know, and you've been around this team, and I've been around other ball clubs that you fight and you claw and you get the lead. And it, I mean, I hate to go back in this comparison, but it's almost Cody Parkey-ish. You know, I mean,
Yes,
you put yourself in a position to win the game and
double dunk.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go.
It just so frustrating. And so you've got we got the Brewers now, the Cardinals up ahead, and then. Then they're here, I believe.
It's a long stretch of games against these two teams.
But this is the playoffs.
Well, yeah, and it's difficult to deal with because you saw what happened toward the end of last year, and that was, it was pretty much a playoff game every game, and it really sapped the life out of that Cubs team. I really believe that because they weren't the same. They weren't the same team that played, earlier in that year.
No.
But, you get yourself into that situation. That's the problem. You know, this is a team that was probably built to be several more games over 500 than they are, and for whatever reason it's not working out right now, so you change the mojo a little bit and you make some deals. I know GMs don't like to make deals just to do it, but sometimes you got to shake things up a little bit,
and they need to be shaken up. Yeah. They really do, especially this road record is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's terrible. And playoff teams win games on the road.
They haven't. I don't think they've won 20 games on the road.
19.
And as I said, we're almost out of July here.
Yeah, it's disheartening. I mean, it's a disheartening stretch, and it's just been one of those stretches that's been. It's been a head scratcher because a lot of people are trying to figure out what exactly is going on, what exactly is wrong. I mean, it's the same basic core, and it's a pretty talented core. There's just some holes that I think that Theo may have backed himself into a corner on a couple of contracts that he issued over the last couple of years, and it kind of limits what you can do.
Yeah, it's. It's frustrating. It's really frustrating, and I'm sure the players are frustrated too.
Yeah, I mean, especially after a game like last night.
Exactly. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy's here with the latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin, and engineer Bob is out enjoying the newsroom slip and slide. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this beautiful Sunday morning. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Kind of a strange week at work this week. After the show on Sunday, kind of relaxing a little bit, and unfortunately, I should know better, but looked at my social media, and there I find the Facebook posting of the Illinois Republican County Chairman's Association with a movie-like poster touting the jihad squad of the four freshman congresswomen that President Trump has been attacking. Then you follow that up with the Kankakee County Democrats with their KKK hat to make America hate again. And then there's a story that didn't get much attention up here. It's been getting a lot of attention in central Illinois involving downstate Congressman Rodney Davis's reelection campaign. And there was a conference call, press media call, that was held by his Democratic opponent, Betsy Dirksen Londrigan. It was one of those, you get a call-in code and whatever, and it's kind of like a telephone press conference. And there was a Davis guy who got on the call, said he was a reporter with the SIU Edwardsville student newspaper, and peppered Londrigan with questions off the Rodney Davis campaign talking points. Nick Klitzing is the guy's name. He was former executive director of the Illinois Republican Party. He made up this name, said he was with the SIU student newspaper, which is the Elestle.
Just search TRAF.
The Elestle. And actually, I'm probably one of the few people who knows what Elestle means. It's from the three campuses that started SIU Edwardsville, Alton, East St. Louis, and Edwardsville. I worked at that student newspaper. And you've got this clown impersonating a reporter in a press conference to assist his political friend, making up names. You talk about fake news. People who complain about fake news, and here you have a fake reporter to assist a campaign. I'm just, this is, the guy's a joke. Actually, he's an attorney. I don't know what the rules are for attorney registration and disciplinary committee. If that's something they might want to look into, that this is supposed to be a lawyer who basically lies, created a false personality. But I think, you know, this is our politics today. People think this is okay. It's and it comes from the top, quite frankly.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
In instances like this, when reporters have access to the codes, where do they get them? And also, did we ever find out who posted the so-called Jihad Squad post? Where's within the organization?
Normally, yes, there's a code and a phone number. And we don't know the answer of how the Davis campaign...
Because that's like... privileged information. Those aren't. That's not circulated.
Yeah, no, it's not posted publicly for anybody to call in. And no, there's no. I have not seen any information about how they got the phone number or the code, so that this clown could call in and pretend that he worked at the newspaper I used to work for as a student to be a political operative. As far as the social media post from the Republican County Chairman's Association that was taken down. It did have, apparently it was some kind of meme that was being used elsewhere. It did have the logo of the Republican County Chairman's Association on it. The head of the County Chairman's Association is also the Lake County Republican Chairman. Said that there's a multi-level process for putting things on social media. So if there's a multi-level process, how did this get on? That it had to be taken off. Dumb answer. But again, here's our politics today. This is the world we live in. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Had another... interesting tweet from the President of the United States yesterday assailing veteran Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings. Basically, this after a week of the go back to where you came from of the four Democratic congresswomen, another attack on an African-American congressman, basically saying that his district is a rodent-infested mess. And that no human would want to live there. Very strong rebuttal from the one of the anchors at CNN who used to live in Baltimore and considers it his home. The president this morning saying that someone should please explain to Nancy Pelosi, who was recently called racist by those in her own party, that there was nothing wrong with bringing out the very obvious fact that Congressman Elijah Cummings has done a very poor job for his district in the city of Baltimore. Just take a look at the facts. The facts speak louder than words, and that Democrats always play the race card. President went on to question the conditions in San Francisco, which is Pelosi's home district. A big week in Washington last week. The spectacle that was the Robert Mueller congressional testimony before two House committees. Attention focusing on Mueller's performance. But also, he did have some things to say. The president, of course, said Mueller did poorly, but also says it wasn't entirely Bob Mueller's fault.
I think Robert Mueller did a horrible job, both today and with respect to the investigation. But in all fairness to Robert Mueller, he had nothing to work with. You know, you can be a builder, but if they don't give you the right materials, you're not going to build a very good building. Robert Mueller had no material. He had nothing to work with. So obviously he did very poorly today.
Now, the president also said he thought Mueller's testimony was devastating to those Democrats who want to move ahead toward impeaching him.
The Democrats lost so big today. Their party is in shambles right now. They've got the squad leading their party. They are a mess. Where even you take a look at Scribe and you take a look at so many of the people that were the most outspoken. And they say this was a devastating day for the Democrats. And you know it, John, and everybody else knows it. This was a devastating day for the Democrats.
That's President Trump's reaction of the Bob Mueller hearings. Joining me now is Pat Brady. Pat's former head of the state Republican Party. He's with Next Generation Strategies. He's also a former assistant U.S. attorney. Pat, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's great to be here, but I got to do some WGN house cleaning. I talked to Cochran, Steve, on the way over. He said to tell you hello and to plug his show. Otherwise, he won't validate my parking. So,
yes, listen to Steve Cochran mornings on WGN.
I just want my parking validated.
Well, I wanted to get your take of the Mueller hearings, and I guess so many people have talked about his performance because the expectation, you know, there's an expectation game, obviously. Even the Washington Post writing some story about, you know, rumors about Mueller's acumen, and it's like, there is the performance aspect of it, but there's also what he said. And, I mean, I still think words matter.
Oh, yeah. They clearly said that the report, the president's story or narrative, whatever you want to call it, is no collusion, no obstruction.
No obstruction, right.
Which is, in the first 3 minutes of the hearing, that came out clearly that he, the lead investigator, didn't agree with that. But I think what happened is that the Democrats didn't do a very good job presenting. I think if they would have done it chronologically and started with the fact that this started 2 years before President Trump was even involved in the campaign, that the Russians had undergone this extensive effort to infiltrate our elections, that people close to the Trump campaign during the course of the campaign, Manafort, Donald Jr., Mike Flynn, all these people had contacts with the Russians that were actively trying to infiltrate our investigations, that the president took steps when he became president to help Michael Flynn, to help his friends, and then when he ended up firing the FBI director, that's where all this obstruction came in. To me, I laid that out just conceptually. I think it would have been more effective had he done that.
Well, and I wondered about that, too, because you had basically the kind of the two parts of the report, and they started with part two.
Right.
In
Three
judiciary.
Hours. Yeah.
Instead of within the intelligence hearing was focused on Russian involvement, and I thought, why didn't they flip that to kind of lay out, here's the groundwork of what the investigation really was,
right,
and then go to part two, which was the questions on obstruction.
And that's why when this early in this investigation, I thought then he ended up doing it, not because I'm any genius, but one of the first indictments was against the Russians.
Right.
Which I thought was smart to show there is a problem here. And then he had a second indictment against the Russians. And you even saw him get more animated in front of the House Intelligence Committee when he started talking about the thing, I think, that mattered to him most.
He felt, yeah, and you could tell he felt more comfortable. I mean, he had, you know, in some respects, for the Democrats looking for the home run thing, he pretty much took the ball away when he said, you know, I'm not even going to read from my own report here.
Which is that he told them that before.
Yes, right.
And one of the other criticisms I have where the Democrats did, he flat out told me he didn't want to testify. You have uncooperative. A witness that doesn't want to be there. So you have to treat them differently, or at least try to prep them or send a staffer over to say, hey, how are you going to be on this so you can be prepared for it? And I think the combination of that and the third point, just the order presentation, the fact they didn't talk to him, the third point is he did not look well. And he's testified 88 times in front of Congress, and I don't think it's just that he hadn't done it in 6 years. He wasn't ready. He looked like, to me, like he couldn't hear. And he was so I don't know what happened there, but it was all in all for the Democrats that were looking for this impeachment. It's not going to happen, I don't think.
We're speaking with Pat Brady. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We have Pat Brady here in studio, former assistant U.S. attorney, former state Republican Party chairman, now with Next Generation Strategies. And we're kind of reviewing former special counsel Bob Mueller's testimony before the two House committees. You know, even though before we went to break, you said you don't think impeachment is going to happen. But yet in recent days, we have seen more Democrats actually step up and say that they want to see impeachment proceedings begin.
Yeah, and you understand the math. They might be able to get it through the House committee, but it's going to die in the Senate. So what's the point when you take a huge political risk? You saw what happened when Republicans impeached Bill Clinton. I think he left with, 58% approval rating. It backfired terribly. Plus, I think we're that close to the election. Why do it? If you want to remove him, if the people really want them removed, impeachment is a political process,
right?
Then let's let the election happen.
Well, you know, and you've got Jerry Nadler, the House Judiciary Chairman, Democrat from New York, going to court basically to try to get documents that and cites the fact that it's part of the reason is because of the Congress's power to impeach, that these documents should be provided. I mean, it seems pretty clear he wants to go ahead.
I think if you looked at that panel, I didn't get a chance to do it, to see everybody on the panel that's pushing for impeachment, to see if they have a primary opponent. And I think Nadler does. So I think the ones that are pushing for it, it's more about their local politics than it really is about national politics.
But you're still talking, I mean, over 90 Democrats now in the House, which is, you know, that's a significant number.
That's a big number. I think they make a huge mistake if they do that. I did see a poll this morning that has not support for impeachment up, but people that don't want it done, down. So I'm not sure if that makes any difference. I'm saying fewer people are opposed to it. But we're old. So we've been through this will be our third one, right?
Yes.
Other than the Nixon, he ended up resigning. I think that was a different era. But the Clinton thing was just the country took its eye off the ball. That's when Bin Laden and the others were over there building up their empires, and it's just a bad thing for the country, I think.
Well, but I mean, with Clinton though, let's look at the basic genesis of that was not Whitewater or anything else. It was over his dalliance.
Yeah, well, and lying under oath. Yeah,
and it was lying under oath about that.
Yeah, the second count, like within the Nixon case, was obstruction,
right?
Impeachment article.
But here you're dealing with more matters, I think, you know, related to the governance.
I read the report twice. That says more about my social life than it does anything. But if you read that report and the way they laid it out, there's a lot of bad information in there, primarily about what the Russians are trying to do. And now that the more intelligence reports are coming out, they're targeting all 50 states by the bad actions of the people around the Trump campaign. But remember, the Trump campaign, that wasn't exactly the A-team.
No.
And even when they talk about obstruction as it relates to, the conspiracy as it relates to Donald Jr., in the report it basically says these guys didn't understand campaign finance laws, and we're not going to indict somebody that just really didn't have a clue about that this could be seen as a illegal contribution. So there's a lot in there. It's just, but I think that report, it's done.
Well, but isn't there a certain amount of naivete that when you're offered dirt on your opponent by a foreign government or foreign agents, that's you report that to U.S. authorities?
I wouldn't even say naivete. I think it's just stupid. I mean, the Russians are coming. They're not exactly our friends. When he texted back, oh, I love it, particularly knowing that WikiLeaks has hacked into the DNC and this is the information you're going to get. But then again, as you said, the tone set at the top is dad's out saying, I love WikiLeaks.
Right.
So when you set that kind of tone, maybe they think it's okay.
It's just confounding.
It is.
And you know, Mueller too is when we talked about his testimony, but you know, to Ted Lieu, where he basically said, you know, yeah, I could indict him after he leaves office, and then he was forced to clean himself up and say, I hadn't reached a conclusion on obstruction.
Yeah, that when that was offered, I said, no, that's not what he's saying. He's saying he can be indicted, not that I would indict him. And we never, if you have read the report, he says that he didn't make a binary prosecute, not prosecute decision like you typically do. He laid out the reasons. Even in the, they talk about the OLC memo that people, I'm sure, are sick of talking about.
OLC.
Yeah, the Office of Legal Counsel, that says you can't indict a sitting president. He put more meat on that bone than it came out in the testimony. He did that because he goes, if we can't indict him, if we issue a report saying he's engaged in criminal conduct, he has no chance to rebut that. He's got to wait till he gets out. So it kind of in the weeds and got confusing, but it was all lost in the white noise of just not a very good presentation.
But again, it did not exonerate the president, as he claims that he's been exonerated.
No, absolutely, it did not exonerate him. It's stated in the report. Bob Mueller restated that in his testimony. So when the president goes out and says no collusion, which again is not a legal term, no obstruction, he's lying. The one thing from reading the obstruction side too, you realize that the president and the people around him, truth is just an option with them. They lie about everything, and they lied about everything. That's why four of them got indicted. And, which is a serious thing to lie to federal agents. So that's another takeaway, at least I got from reading the memo.
I want to ask you about this, what we've seen, the tweets from the president, both involving the squad, as well as even yesterday with Elijah Cummings. And it seems that there is a policy, a politically motivated policy here, that playing this game involving race is to build to retain his base.
Yeah, the 42% that he'll always have. But you look at those tweets, and I know it's an old cliche, but politics is about addition, not subtraction. I don't understand why he continues to do this, because where we live, those kind of tweets, they're going to hurt Republicans in the two congressional districts we're trying to win back. They hurt us 2 years ago. I still think that Randy Hulker and Peter Raskin lost primarily because the president was so unpopular. So I don't know what his end game is beyond the people that are going to support him anyway.
Well, and I thought it was interesting too. Politico was saying that the president was looking at some kind of strategy to try to, you know, win those suburban districts and win back the suburban districts that he had lost, and then as well as make inroads in urban districts. And then you go from that to, you know, saying that this district in Baltimore is that no human being would live there. And how, I mean, that runs completely counter to
the only thing I right now keeping that strategy alive, I believe, is the Democrats are not offering, I don't think, enough of an option to get the people that aren't necessarily progressive Democrats, can't stand the president and didn't vote for him before and aren't going to vote for him this time, but they're just not going to run to the Democrats, because there's really no the policies that we're seeing from some of the Democrats outside of Joe Biden are way too far to the left for most people, particularly in the suburbs in this country. So I'm waiting for some Democrats to step up and come up with some policies that fit more to the middle, because they're going way to the extreme too, I think.
Sure, and obviously when we're seeing that messaging in on the congressional level and campaigns here and throughout the country, where you just, if you're the Republican, you automatically label the Democrat as socialist, whatever, fill in the blank name there, and to try to, you know, attach that label there.
Well, I think too the Democrats have made a mistake in that they overreact to everything. He does a stupid thing a day. He's already done it this morning. He'll do four or five more probably before the end of the day. Quit reacting to it and start talking about what you're going to do. I think that's more effective than every day having a breathless outrage about what Donald Trump did. I think it's already kind of the default position. We've already factored all that in, that they need to, I think,
go beyond.
Go beyond, yeah.
That's Pat Brady, former head of the state Republican Party with Next Generation Strategies. Pat, as always, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me plug Cochran.
I'm sure he thanks you as well.
See you guys. Have a good day.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. The last segment with Pat Brady, we were talking about Bob Mueller's testimony before House Intelligence and House Judiciary Committees. Mueller, the statements he made were largely confined to his April report, but there were a couple that I thought were interesting. One went right at Trump, who's complained that the Mueller investigation was a witch hunt and a hoax. Under questioning from House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff, this is what Mueller had to say.
Number of persons that we interviewed in our investigation, it turns out, did lie.
Mike Flynn lied?
He was convicted of lying, yes.
George Papadopoulos was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was, in fact, went so far as to encourage other people to lie?
That is accurate.
Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, lied?
That is accurate.
Michael Cohen, the president's lawyer, was indicted for lying?
True.
He lied to stay on message with the president?
Allegedly by him.
And when Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
Then, appearing before the Judiciary Committee, Mueller also repudiated another of Trump's claims that the Mueller report had exonerated him and that there was no collusion. Here's House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler questioning Mueller.
Director Mueller, the president has repeatedly claimed that your report found there was no obstruction and that it completely and totally exonerated him. But that is not what your report said, is it?
Correct. It is not what the report said.
Now, reading from page 2 of volume 2 of your report that's on the screen, you wrote, quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment," close quote. Now, does that say there was no obstruction?
No.
In fact, you were actually unable to conclude the president did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
Well, we, at the outset, determined that we, when it came to the president's culpability, we needed to go forward only after taking into account the OLC opinion that indicated that a president, a sitting president, cannot be indicted.
So the report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
So some moments from the testimony last week of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. We're going to switch gears now and talk about an issue that has been a pretty much a significant topic in Illinois over the issue of our water safety. And quite frankly, troubling issues that had previously gotten a lot of attention at the Quincy Veterans Home downstate over annual outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease, fatal outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease. And now we've got some new rules that are going into effect regarding water safety, water management. And joining me now is Brad Considine. He's the Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease. Brad, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Glad to be with you. Thanks.
You know, we talked a lot, and you've been on the show before. We talked a lot about all the attention that you know, the Quincy Veterans Home got over its cases of Legionnaires' disease. But, I mean, Legionnaires is actually, even though that outbreak and issues about how to deal with it, lots of questions involving that. But Legionnaires is something that's still relatively common, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think we're on the front end of trying to get control of the Legionnaires' rates. And I think, you know, the first most important thing to understand in managing the issue is that the majority of the cases are individual and sporadic cases, so they're not a part of an outbreak. And the thing that we've been struggling with is, it's hard to sustain the attention to this complex water system issue. Because the focus is always a response to an emergency or a crisis, and we're not attending to it regularly. And I think that's why we were so excited about the new water rules that were introduced in Illinois and approved just a few weeks ago, because it takes a more comprehensive approach to address bacteria over, you know, a more consistent basis, so it helps to address individual cases as well.
Well, as you say, it gets out in front of the issue rather than trying to be that reactive kind of dealing with these issues. And also, I think you guys have even gone so far as to say it really kind of brings monitoring water systems and water treatment into the 21st century.
It does, and it's long overdue. And, you know, when you think about other things like your food, you know, that we manage and monitor what's in our food, what the ingredients are, we're very careful about it. But we consume water as a matter of course, and we're not aware of what's going on with the water. And the issues of a aging water infrastructure across the United States is compounding the issue. We have more than 1 million miles of water distribution across the country, and most of it is now getting beyond its projected original life expectancy. And it's all hidden underground, so it's very hard for, you know, to get that topic on the table.
We're speaking with Brad Considine. He's the Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Brad Considine, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires' Disease. We're talking about some new water safety rules that the state has adopted, dealing with Legionnaires' disease as well as just water treatment, water safety, something that we all kind of take for granted. And Brad, you mentioned about the infrastructure, and that's a significant issue with the, you know, the city of Chicago and lead pipes and those kinds of things. And I'm not sure that the nation really has come to grips about, you know, the depth of what we have to do to repair that infrastructure.
No, I don't think we have, but there are a number of groups where I think the discussion is growing around the issue of our water infrastructure. It was the National Summit on Waterborne Pathogens, which pathogens is a reference to bacteria and organisms that can cause illness, but regarding water infrastructure in Washington, D.C. this past month. And it was one of the first times we got together such a nice cross-function of experts and EPA and academics that have studied and done the research and manufacturers and so on. And I think they all concluded that this conversation has to get elevated. And we're looking for some of that leadership on the government side to help pull those groups together to sustain the conversation. But as we become increasingly aware that water infrastructure is a major factor, if not the leading factor, and is compounded by some parts of the country where we have shrinking cities, where, you know, the water becomes more stagnant, and stagnancy is a real issue for bacterial growth, and they also get more fragile. And whenever you have disruptions in the water system, they disturb what's in the pipes and send that material down through the distribution system into our homes and workplaces. So it is an item that we need to continue to keep in front of the public.
So give us an idea of what are we looking at in these new rules? What will change here?
Well, overall, they give community water suppliers new guidance for how they operate, maintain, and design their system. But specifically, they have requirements, for example, on water storage, making sure that there's turnover of the water storage so that you don't have this stagnancy issue. If you look at the Quincy Veterans Home, you know, one of the things they did is they took down part of the system, part of the infrastructure, and the water sat at about 80 to 90 degrees, and it ultimately developed, you know, bacterial growth and so on. And then they restarted the system and sent that material down through the water system. So that turnover requirement and managing that is critical. The other one is better control of water age. Water that ages develops all kinds of issues with regard to consuming the chlorine, developing byproducts, and so forth. And these guidelines will affect how water pressure is managed, the water main sizing, eliminating inactive piping sections, which are what we call dead legs where water can sit, and then promotes more flushing of that water. The third piece is that public records of water upset conditions like water main breaks and so forth need to be recorded. And I think what we're trying to get to is where those upset conditions are communicated, especially to large complex buildings and hospitals and healthcare facilities, because the people trying to manage it in the building need to know what's going on in the system. And I'd say the last part is that it does require an increase in a minimum residual disinfectant being present in the water throughout. And the reason for that is in many cases with the chlorine being consumed upstream, by the time it gets into our homes, it no longer has disinfectant present. And if the water main breaks and the bacteria gets into the system, you need disinfectant to take care of the bacteria.
So what is that disinfectant?
Well, typically, I think, is chlorine. They also use the chloramine, and they have increased it to a 0.5 milligrams of free chlorine. The EPA allows up to 4 milligrams, which is really eight times that amount in total. And so this is to make sure that there's actually more disinfectant at the point it's entering into the buildings, rather than increasing the chlorine that people would end up consuming.
And so, I mean, this is to be done by the water treatment agencies, the management agencies.
Exactly. And there's a variety of techniques of how they can ensure that it's in place. There's some flexibility for how they administer it, but it's just increasing the requirement that the water that we receive is truly disinfected.
Yeah, well, you mentioned about, you know, how important it is for larger buildings, and you know, we talked about Quincy. I mean, just on Friday, I believe it was, the State Department of Public Health that was investigating two cases of Legionnaires in patients, two patients at Rush Oak Park Hospital, one in May and the other in July. And here again, you know, not to try to create a cause of concern here, but you know that when you have healthcare facilities like we saw in Quincy, you know, that raises questions about what is going on with the water management.
It does. does, and I think what's really a focus is the healthcare facilities, because this bacteria, yeah, basically we probably all interact with this bacteria, and when our bodies are healthy, we generally, you know, don't have an issue with it. But the immune compromised, people that are, you know, seeking treatment for cancer, the elderly, the people that had a variety of issues are more at risk. And so consequently, at hospitals, you know, that's where the sick, immune compromised people, you know, travel and frequent. So the federal government just put out new regulations a couple of years ago that actually have higher requirements for hospitals to maintain, you know, their part of the system. But to your point, the only way to really, for them to be effective, is to know the water quality that's coming into their buildings. And too often when there is an outbreak, we have people going just to the building, just to points of exposure, a faucet, a shower head, you know, a hot tub or something, and we're not considering how that bacteria got there in the first place. And I think what we need is really a source to tap, is really the a range of solutions that are source to tap. And I think the new water guidelines will step up the management of the water quality coming to the buildings. And then I think, you know, we could, there's a number of great new practices for building owners on how to mitigate the risk. There's a new standard in 2015 from ASHRAE, which is a trade association, on mitigating the risk of Legionella in buildings. So there's increasing guidance, and we just need to bring it together and execute.
Brad, real quickly, someone on the text line wants to know about, are there any changes to domestic hot water temperatures and management?
There was some discussion about that, but obviously there's always the scalding risk, and there's none required that I'm aware of in these water guidelines. But on the temperature issue, you know, water at 140 to 160 starts to kill off the bacteria. You know, water at, you know, 80 to 100, it tends to be when the bacteria thrives.
That's Brad Considine, Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Alliance to Prevent Legionnaires Disease. Brad, as always, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by my good friend Brian Bernadone, who, after 17 years as the government affairs strategist for the Chicago Association of Realtors, it will be departing officially on October 1. Brian, thank you so much for joining me. And let's get it out of the way. The mandatory Sven Gulli mention.
It's not mandatory. It's obligatory. But, I'm a little groggy after last night.
I support Rich, too.
Yeah,
so,
I'm a little bit tired. Forbidden Planet was on last night, which is an absolute sci-fi classic.
Yes.
And we're celebrating the 40th year of Sven Gulli broadcasting in Chicago. And for those of you who are watching the webcam, this is the official Sven Gulli t-shirt, which I got this week just in time for this program. So,
you know, that, and it's a terrific shirt.
It's a classic. Yes. It's a classic.
Nothing.
Oh, beautiful. You see, this is why I love WGN. Good morning, Chicago.
We know how to dodge everything here. It's no, I like that, the chicken with the
it's glow in the dark. I mean,
I figured as much. You know, yes,
Sven Gulli's got a store.
Yes, yes.
Not and to, by the way, there's no sales ever.
Yeah, not to be confused with Schwanee Mart.
Schwanee Mart.
Yes, yes.
I got those golf balls. I've been trying to return them, and I no luck.
They don't take returns either at Schwanee Mart.
No luck.
We've learned that.
No luck.
So, man, 17 years.
Yeah. I had the greatest client in Chicago. You know, when you represent realtors, you're representing, you know, these are hardworking people. They're out there every day. They're in every neighborhood. And I'm really blessed to have worked for the Illinois Realtors and worked with Chicago for so long to really learn the city up and down. Even in the last week, you know, I had meetings over in on the south side and in different neighborhoods. And, when you're having breakfast at Daly's at 63rd and what is it, Cottage Grove? I think that's right.
I think that's right.
And you just know the neighborhood so well, and you know the community leaders. That's a experience I'll never be able to get again.
Well, and I think of you as a on the street person.
You got to be. I don't think lobbying behind a desk is ever a good idea. I think you got to be out in the neighborhood. You got to touch people. You've got to be able to see what they see and feel what they feel. If you're not seeing neighborhoods, I think a lot of people, you know, put out, you know, I was in Englewood, or I was in Auburn Gresham, or I was in Pilsen. If you can't describe those neighborhoods, if you can't see those neighborhoods, I don't think you can really represent people and talk to legislators about what you're actually seeing, feeling, hearing.
Well, and you've always talked about, I mean, the guy that runs the hot dog stand. I mean, and the real touchstones of neighborhood business.
And what scares me about what I see now, and I think what's going to be an issue not only for the realtors and for other business groups, but I think also for the city of Chicago, is the things that make Chicago so unique, whether it's the hot dog stand, the burrito stand, whether it's the fisheries, whether it's, you know, just regular mom and pop businesses. If we don't start getting a grip on how we are taxing these people out of business, we're in real trouble. And I go down streets, you know, I come downtown in different ways from my little hovel out by Midway. And, you know, I'll take the Polish Expressway. I'll take Archer Avenue down. You know, I'll go down the Stevenson. I'll go down, you know, 290, or I'll go down some, or Ogden coming in. And what concerns me is places that I used to go to as a kid, places that I knew as a teenager, places that I frequented as an adult, are now disappearing. And those were the things that were unique. I mean, when you start seeing large conglomerates taking and surrounding Margie's Candies over in Bucktown, yeah, I'm concerned about it. You know, I would love my kids to enjoy Margie's Candies or Rainbow Cone or those kind of things. And those businesses, I think, are considerably at risk. A friend of mine owns a major steakhouse in Chicago, and Fraternity Brother, a kid who grew up like I did in the Near West Side. And, you know, when you see his second installment of his property taxes double, that's a game changer. And I think those are going to be major issues I think the real estate community and again, the city of Chicago are going to have to contend with. This is a great city, but if we're going to maintain it as a great city, we've got to really start looking at how small businesses and neighborhoods are being impacted by what we're doing downtown.
Well, and taxes have always been a concern, but I think you alluded to something in one of the stories, the numerous stories I saw paying honor to your years at the Realtors, was about there's all of these governmental entities that are taxing bodies, but there's only one taxpayer.
Yeah, I think the news narrative is very interesting in this town, that, you know, we like the drama of politicians going after each other. We like the idea that there's contention or split between what was the monolith of the Democratic Party, and now you see this infighting. But I think for the working family, for the small business person, however that's defined, you're a single taxpayer. After all the politics are aside on the fifth floor or the third floor or down in Springfield or out in Capitol Hill, it's a tax bill and you got to pay it. And I think that as we sit right now, again, another issue I think real estate's going to have to look to and other business groups are going to have to contend with, we've got to look at the tax stack. We always talk about how things are financed as a stack in developing high-rise buildings or other kinds of developments. I think we got to start looking now seriously at that tax stack and realizing together that bill is getting pretty hefty compared to other places. I think Illinois Policy and a lot of other people do studies on it, but they don't really touch the fact that these bills are on a pace to go up, not down. Things that we know are already going to happen are already in place. You can't stop. The assessments happening, the assessment increases that were happening in North Township likely are going to happen in the South and definitely will happen in the city. You can't stop that. That's going to happen. That's an inevitability. But then when you look at the prospects of perhaps the governor's tax increase getting passed, when you look at the fact that we don't have fire budget, we don't have a policeman's budget, we don't have a teacher's budget.
Contract.
We don't have a contract for those folks. those are things that are not going to only go forward, but they have retroactive in there as well, which means taxes are inevitably going to go up. How we deal with that and how we can still sell Chicago as a great place to work, live, and play, how we can sell neighborhoods as a great place to invest, those all get challenged by that primary tax stack. If you know what that tax bill is going to look like, it's going to make you sheepish about trying to invest in this town.
We're speaking with Brian Bernardoni, who is leaving his post after 17 years as government affairs strategist for the Association of Realtors. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio, my good friend Brian Bernardoni, who after 17 years is leaving his post as the government affairs strategist for the Association of Realtors. And gone but not forgotten, though. I mean,
this is not an obituary.
Yeah, well, that's I was joking with him, you know, about I don't want to make it an obituary at all.
Gosh, no. I mean, after being with the Realtors for 17 years, I feel like I'm a teenager, and now this is the next path as I walk towards adulthood here.
Well, you were mentioning off air about you're still going to be on a number of different task forces.
Yeah, I'm real like fortunate. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development made me the chairperson of their Affordable Housing Task Force for 5 states in Region 5, and I'm going to retain those roles as well as my role with the Civic Federation, as well as my role with the Salvation Army. So it's very nice that I have the opportunity to use this year of growth as also a year to still maintain my civic positions across the city and across the region.
So what's next?
Well, it's been an exciting few weeks as we've been kind of finalizing where we wanted to go, but I'm going to be forming a group called the Aurelius Public Affairs Group. Marcus Aurelius was the great general who was at the largest size of Rome. He was the person in charge of it, and he had a real good philosophy about if it's not right, don't do it. If it's not true, don't say it. And as this has always been a part of what I believed as a core. The one book I read twice a year is Marcus Aurelius's his treatise on and his philosophy. And for me, I wanted to work with people I thought that were, to be candid, solution-oriented, people that were ethical, people that were going to be willing to go through the barriers of being transparent in this town. I think politics is shifting, and people want to know what lobbyists are doing, what people want to know what politicians are doing. And you have to be prepared for that. That has to be part of your you know, I hate to use the word, it has to be part of your ethos, that you're prepared to be transparent, you're prepared to go down this route. So when I was conceiving where I was going to go and what I was going to do, I wanted to work with people that I wanted to work with that I knew matched that kind of thing, that they were going to be solution-oriented, that they were going to be ethical, that they were going to approach things the way I see it. There's no shortcuts in good public policy. When you see people trying to take shortcuts, I think that's where lobbyists and politicians get in trouble. We've got it. These are serious problems facing Chicago and the region. You've got to be serious when you're representing clients in that way. So what I decided to do was I wanted to reach out to friends I wanted to do business with, not for a week or a month, but for the rest of my career. So I'm really happy to announce that I'm partnering with Gary Chico. Gary ran for, as everyone knows, for mayor of the city of Chicago, but he also ran for the Senate. But he also has a vast career and a vast experience of understanding educational policy, which is always something I've been interested in. Gary has been a person that I've long wanted to affiliate with in a formal way, so I'll be affiliating with Gary Chico. But problems in Chicago aren't always just solved in Chicago, so I needed to have a partnership in Washington, D.C. So I'm going to be working with the firm of Dillard & King out of Washington, D.C. They have a long experience in very technical regulatory issues, so I'm very happy to do that. I'm also going to be partnering with the team in Springfield. We're finalizing the deal on that, but I'm also going to be partnering with the Balduzzi Group out of New York City. Balduzzi does a lot of political campaign advertising. They were very, to be candid, they were integral in our success in winning 10 of the 12 races we engaged in the city council this last runoff, as well as 5 of the 7 of the independent expenditures, which are the larger campaigns that we did. So it's been interesting in that aspect on the lobbying side, but I also get to do some public policy work, and I want to carve out some space to actually do technical work, and I have some opportunities that have been presented to myself in that reign. And lastly, I think, and I want to thank you, Rick, specifically for this. You've given me the opportunity to share opinions. I think that having been the lobbyist for the realtors for 17 years, I've got a well-honed idea of what the issues are in the city of Chicago and what those positions look like. So I'd like to actually do maybe some opinion writing and get into that mode, because I think there needs to be a voice for business. Be candid, I've represented business interests in Chicago for more than 17 years. I used to represent Little Italy for 4 years. I represented BOMA. I've been across the table from labor. I've been across the table from the city. I've been across the labor table from actual, you know, other business groups and negotiate with them so we could collaborate and work together. I've had the biggest stake in lobbying in the city of Chicago for that time period. 17 years is a long time. It's been a good run. Our members have been able to enjoy how they work unimpeded, usually, you know, for most part, for 17 years. But what I think I have after those 17 years is I'm very comfortable in the space of being able to speak for other businesses and other business groups, because I've been at the table. And I think as we move forward, you're going to have clarion voices. You can't blow an uncertain trumpet in this business. You've got to be very clear about where you're going and what we're going to do. I seek to obviously represent other business organizations, but I think the most important thing that Aurelius will do is we're going to work the back offices of lobbying. For us, for me particularly, I'm one lobbyist. The reason why I was so good is because I had amazing realtor members that was always the threat that I'm going to push that button and 18,000 or 40,000 or 55,000 realtors are going to light up your phone. I want to bring that same technique to other clients to show them, look, this is a technique that worked. We were very successful for 17 years. And as a result, we can do that kind of messaging and assistance for them. Chicago's too important to lose, I think, to the progressives. I think Chicago's too important to lose to the ideas that everyone should pay and we'll see what happens. I think we all need to work together, progressives, business, and otherwise, to continue to make Chicago the great place to live, work, and play.
Quite an agenda.
Well, it's the agenda I've followed for the last 17 years. I mean, I don't think it changes too much. Frankly, I've tried to bring that kind of passion to the realtors for the 17 years I was there. And to me, it's now an opportunity to broaden that hat and share it with other groups and hopefully make Chicago a success as a result of it.
Brian Bernadone, on to new adventures.
Every day is an adventure in Chicago.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Brian, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.